Exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Solat Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Makamura Shava, said mutual ties with Iran is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Pakistanis take to the streets across the country on Kashmir Solidarity Day to condemn what they call the illegal occupation of Jammu and Kashmir regions by India. The rallies were held along with a host of events, including conferences and seminars, attended by senior government officials and lawmakers in such major cities as Lahore, Karachi and Islamabad. Kashmir Solidarity Day is marked in Pakistan every year on February 5. The day marks the nation's renewed commitment to the people of Indian-administered Kashmir. Participants in the rallies demanded the UN Security Council to implement its resolutions on Kashmiris' right to self-determination and end what they called the bloodshed in the Indian-administered Jammu and Kashmir.
Observance of Solidarity Day on February 5 is proof of Pakistan's continued support for Kashmiris. We will never accept India's occupation of Jammu and Kashmir and will continue our struggle for the independence of the Kashmiri people.
The purpose of celebrating the day is to renew the pledge that the people of Pakistan will continue to provide moral, political, and diplomatic support to their Kashmiri brothers and sisters until the independence of Indian-occupied Kashmir.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority region, is divided into Indian and Pakistani sections, but claimed by both in full. The Kashmir dispute has led to several wars between the nuclear-armed rivals since Pakistan's independence in 1947.
The United Nations should play its role in ending the decades-long sufferings of Kashmiris who are struggling for their right to self-determination. The world should urge India to hold composite and meaningful dialogues with all the stakeholders to resolve the dispute.
Relations between India and Pakistan worsened in 2019 when the Indian government revoked Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which granted Indian-administered Kashmir partial autonomy.
Islamabad has long argued that Kashmir should have acceded to Pakistan because of its Muslim majority population. However, the cold response from India in this regard has put the matter on hold. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
South Korean families of the victims of the crowd crush that killed 159 mostly young people last Halloween gathered at the memorial in Itaewon on Saturday to mark 100 days since the tragedy. They demand a thorough independent probe and accountability.
We definitely need to know the reason why our children died here last October 29th. I think the only thing we can do for our sons and daughters who left this world for no reason is to hold those responsible and punish them.
Demonstrators marched from the memorial past the presidential office. 11 emergency calls were made in the hours before the disaster. Local officials knew tens of thousands would gather in Itaewon, but crowd control was not implemented. Still, the safety minister said the deaths could not have been prevented, angering family members. One investigation has led to a handful of indictments of police on duty and low-level officials, but top officials have been spared.
Naturally, it is the President, the Minister of the Interior and Safety, and the Commissioner of the National Police Agency who are obliged to take responsibility for the lives and safety of citizens. But from the beginning, right after the disaster, they sought to avoid responsibility, and politicians continue to insult the families and victims.
City Hall denied the marchers access to the nearby plaza for their demonstration, as the fallout from the tragedy turns ever more political. 26 foreigners died in the crowd crush last Halloween. Five of those were young Iranian exchange students. And as the families and their supporters seek justice, they face harassment and official indifference. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The political crisis deepens in Peru, where the legislative body has rejected President Dina Boluarte's bid to move elections to this year. Congress shelved the bill due to objections raised in a meeting of the Constitutional Committee on Friday. The matter is unlikely to be discussed before July, when Congress begins its new session. Lawmakers had previously agreed to move the date of the elections from 2026 to April 2024, but it could not calm the protesters. Boluarte thinks the reschedule of the voting to this year might help mitigate unrest and chaos. The South American country has been in the grip of unrest since early December. There have been frequent clashes between protesters and police in several cities, almost on a daily basis. Confrontations have resulted in dozens of deaths. Apart from early elections, Peruvian protesters also demand President Boluarte step down.
We are outraged by the injustice that is happening, by the police repression, by the deaths, by the lack of justice, also because the people are demanding the resignation of the president.
However, Boluarte has defied the calls, accusing those demanding her resignation of pursuing political blackmail.
My resignation is not at stake in this situation. There is a minority of the population, of these groups that are generating violence and chaos in the country, who are pushing for my resignation in a blackmailing manner. And we are not going to give in to this political blackmail.
The protests have also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with workers being hit hard. The unrest has negatively affected the export of goods and the operation at key mines, which are major sources of income for the Andean nation. The protesters around the country have blocked highways, causing shortages of food, fuel, and other essentials in several regions. Hundreds of trucks remain stranded at the border with Bolivia, awaiting the end of a strike called by the protesters.
We are suffering every day. There's nothing to eat. Look how the roads are. You can't even walk, no motorcycle, no car, nothing. Dina Boluarte's government do not pay attention to what the people are demanding. What more do they want? How many more deaths?
Peru's unrest has been propelled mainly by indigenous people from the south. That's where ousted President Pedro Castillo comes from. He was removed from office and arrested in early December as he was attempting to shutter Congress to stave off his impeachment. The demonstrators demand his release because they regard Castillo as the one who can fight poverty and inequality. It seems that the fundamental problems driving the unrest will not go away, as the protesters are not only angry over stark inequality, but they feel neglected by state institutions, especially Congress, which many Peruvians say are being run by corrupt lobbies and vested interests.
The recent decision by the European Central Bank to raise interest rates by a further 0.5% has thrown Italian families and small and medium entrepreneurs into the depths of gloom. Prices in Italy rose 8.1% year-on-year in 2022, hitting a 37-year high. Now Italians see themselves stuck between a rock and a hard place. The country's inflation rate had shot up to around 12% in the months between October and December, a trend also seen across Europe. This is due to soaring energy and food prices linked primarily to the conflict in Ukraine and the related rearmament spending that all members of the bloc are engaged in. But it's also caused by the governments having thrown support packages worth hundreds of billions of euros at the corporations and the rich over the past years.
High inflation, soaring energy bills are biting hard. In addition to that, our average salaries have not kept up pace, and they have not gone up for years. It's really worrying.
Quite simply, I went to buy food at the supermarket last week, and the items I usually buy for 30 euros cost me about 50 euros instead.
Although inflation rates have recorded a clear abatement across Europe, Italy is still dealing with two-digit inflation, which stands at over 10%. The European Central Bank's latest rate hike has brought to 3% the total of interest rate increases over the past 6 months. The EU's governing council is expected to raise them further next month.
These moves by the ECB adopted to slow inflation don't seem to have worked very much so far. The problems affecting our economy seem to be rather structural, and this situation has led citizens and businesses to lose confidence in a real recovery.
According to a survey of some 27,000 citizens commissioned by the European Parliament, more than 9 out of 10 of Europeans are very concerned about the rising cost of living. 40% of the people living in the EU feel they are already struggling to pay for food and other basics, and almost 1 in 2 says the standard of living has fallen. But more worryingly, they are not holding out much hope for the future, either, as another 39% expect the standard of living to fall this year. Max Civili, Rome.
The 53rd exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry achievements was inaugurated in Tehran on Thursday. The event showcases the latest nuclear products made in Iran. Attended by head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, the expo put on display different applications of the nuclear sector, from centrifuges to radiopharmaceuticals and particle accelerators.
Despite all external pressures, we have managed to advance our nuclear sector, and this expo shows a small part of it. Today, we have become self-sufficient in nuclear fuel, radiomedicine, and many other fields such as heavy water.
In recent years, Iran has been trying to diversify the applications of its nuclear sector. Besides power generation, the country is now focusing on particle accelerators for food irradiation and radiotherapy.
Irradiation systems are being built in Iran on a national scale. This will allow the country to irradiate all its food and agricultural products. This way, we can reduce food waste, ensure food security for our people, and enhance our agricultural exports.
Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry in 2006, it has constantly been targeted by sanctions over what the West calls fears of a nuclear bomb, something which Tehran categorically rejects, saying its nuclear program is civilian and peaceful.
As you know, the West has long been leading a psychological campaign against Iran's nuclear activity, accusing Iran of pursuing non-peaceful purposes. So we held this exhibition for our people to see for themselves that our nuclear program is peaceful.
following the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions against Tehran in 2018, Iran took retaliatory steps by scaling back its commitments to the pact. The Vienna discussions between Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal, which aimed to revive the accord, have remained stalled since August last year. This, as Tehran says, it will come back to full compliance only if Washington removes all its sanctions.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions cannot disrupt its nuclear program. At the same time, the AEOI says it will continue to build up the country's nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Black Lives Matter. This is a popular slogan we often come across in the streets of the United States following the fatal shooting and beating to death of African Americans there. That began with the racially motivated killing of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, among others. Anger and shock once again prevail as American protesters march in cities to denounce police brutalities and demand justice for another victim, 29-year-old Tyre Nichols. The man was beaten to death by a group of officers in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, after he was stopped for a traffic violation in early January. Nichols was in confusion as to why he had been stopped, but before he could know, the cops started kicking, punching, and pepper spraying him while he was crying for help. Nichols was pronounced dead in a hospital 3 days later. Activists are still in disbelief on how the police could treat a member of the society like Nichols as an enemy in the battlefield.
Here I am now in 2023, and I'm looking at another video, this in color, where I'm seeing another black man being beat to death. Rodney didn't die. This is worse. It's beat to death with no mercy on no crime that they can even find that he had committed.
Here at Nichols' funeral, his family desperately called for an end to police brutality against the African-American community.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, who was also present at the funeral, slammed the killing and talked about an act that has a slim chance of getting passed in the Congress. Ironically, U.S. officials have turned up on such occasions in the past and made similar promises, but to no avail. Figures show that police brutality remained as rampant as it had been in the previous years. Law enforcement killed nearly 1,200 people or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. Repeated shooting and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's black community. Many believe the reoccurrence of the brutal scene cannot be prevented by just suspending culprits. No African American will truly become safe from police brutality until its root causes are identified and dealt with.
The most prestigious cinematic event in Iran has kicked off once again, bringing together filmmakers, directors, and members of the cast and crew, as well as movie lovers and moviegoers in Tehran. The 41st edition of the Fajr Film Festival opened with the screening of the movie Maestro by Imad Hosseini, an adaptation of Alina by David Mamet. A clear sign that this year we should be expecting a very different film festival. First and foremost is the conspicuous presence of first-time directors.
24 movies will be competing in the main categories. These movies were picked out of 87 movies that were submitted to the Secretariat. All the 24 movies will be screened first in Tehran and in about a week in 30 provinces across the country. The screenings will continue until February 12th.
But that is not all. In the international section, nearly two dozen movies are also taking part. For many of them, this is a regional movie premiere, which is why, as always, the spotlight is on the festival and movies participating in it.
The first days of the festival can tell you a lot about what's going to happen, and by the looks of things, I'm personally expecting to watch some really great movies this year.
Movies will be competing for the top award or the Crystal Seymour in six different sections based on their stories. The Cinema of Salvation, Resistance, Muhammad Amin, and Eastern Vista being the most competitive sections, with all eyes watching to see which movies will take home the Crystal Seymour.
For movie lovers and moviegoers, this is the time to be in Tehran. However, in less than a week, on February the 5th, movie theaters across the country will also be joining in. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
In the limelight.
Yemen's information minister Zaifullah Al-Shami has accused the United States of being largely responsible for the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe in the country. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tasnim News Agency wrote in this regard, in a tweet, Ashami stated that the U.S. is responsible for the suffering of Yemenis, having imposed several rounds of sanctions and blockading entry ports controlled by the Ansarullah resistance movement. According to Shami, the U.S. cannot be relied upon to establish a durable and inclusive peace agreement in Yemen that would alleviate the suffering of its people, as it has created the world's worst humanitarian crisis through support for the Saudi siege and devastating attacks against the nation. The minister also pointed to U.S. history, stating that the country has not shown any help in establishing peace or restoring stability. Shami stressed that the Sana'a government has presented numerous initiatives aimed at securing nationwide peace in Yemen, including proposals put forward by the late head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council and its current chairman. However, these attempts have all been unsuccessful due to the refusal of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to consider the peace proposals, obstructing any negotiations of peace in Yemen, he said. According to Kayhan International, the Yemeni minister has lashed out at the United States and Saudi Arabia over their refusal to study the peace proposals, arguing they obstruct any attempt meant to negotiate peace in Yemen. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the U.S. and other Western states, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbo Mansur Hadi. The Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, leaving hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and spawning the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, Press TV reported Yemen's Ministry of Health has warned of a human catastrophe that threatens the lives of more than 5,000 patients with renal failure as a result of the years-long Saudi blockade and war against the impoverished Arab country. Ali Al-Jahaf, National Salvation Government's Deputy Health Minister, made the remark at a press conference in the capital Sana'a as he raised the alarm about the depletion of the stock of dialysis drugs and medicine for Yemeni patients suffering from chronic kidney disease. This is not the first conference, and we have held more than one. We have been warning of a human catastrophe threatening the lives of thousands of dialysis patients in various governorates, but there is no response, Jahaf was quoted as saying by Yemen's Ansarullah news website. We have addressed the United Nations and health organizations operating in Yemen that we need to provide sufficient drug stocks for dialysis sessions for the year 2023, as we need approximately 500,000 dialysis sessions every year without receiving a response, despite lots of correspondence and meeting in this regard, he added, stressing that dialysis centers in Yemen are standing on the verge of stopping. Jahaf said the issue will affect the lives of 5,000 patients with kidney failure who need dialysis sessions and drugs, and they may lose their lives if these solutions and medicine are not available urgently. The deputy health minister underscored the importance of opening Sana'a Airport and the port of Hodeidah, as they are vital outlets for medicine and food for millions of Yemenis in the besieged areas by the Saudi-led coalition aggression, adding, in light of the imposed blockade, we are unable as a country to import vital medicine and save our patients. Jahaf went on to say that we are in urgent need within 2 weeks to provide dialysis sessions and our stock has run out. Anis al-Asbahi, spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health, also called on international organizations to urgently provide dialysis sessions so that dialysis centers would continue to operate and save the lives of Yemeni patients. Asbahi held the United Nations responsible for saving the lives of dialysis patients and responding to the basic requirements of the Yemeni people under the siege, stressing the need to open Sana'a Airport and Hodeidah Port. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistic support from the U.S. regime and other Western regimes, launched the devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbo Mansur Hadi. While the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Britain is facing yet another strike. This is the largest ever healthcare strike due to pay disputes. Health workers are demanding a pay rise that reflects the worst inflation in Britain in four decades, and also to deal with the cost of living crisis. The government says that would be unaffordable and will not be able to meet this demand. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the UK's precarious economic predicament, one affected by inflation and a cost of living crisis, while plagued with massive protests, which will continue to disrupt the economy even further. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Clive Benzies, researcher and political economy analyst, joins us from London. Also joining us, Shabir Rizvi, economic analyst, who also joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Clive Benzies, first over to you. So we're looking at the largest ever strike by health workers. And just prior to this broadcast, taking a look at some of the towns that are involved here, it seems like towns are added to the list of places where these nurses are striking. and it's not the first strike, but the health sector, which is over the pay rise, amongst other things, actually. Tell us what you think about this. First of all, and I guess in a bigger picture, what's going to happen if neither side gives in, whether it's an offer by the government and then the nurses are not going to go for it, or vice versa?
Thanks for having me back on. The thing is, we tend to focus on news stories as they emerge, and that's not surprising. This is a news channel. But one needs to look at the bigger picture, as you've alluded to, because this is structural. And all of this that is now coming to everyone's notice has been long predictable, as I've said before on your program. And the problem is that if one's addressing the symptoms of a structural issue, one's only playing whack-a-mole, which you may know is a children's game where you have a hammer and you hit things down and other things pop up. And that essentially is what is happening in the way our government responds to the crises as they emerge into public consciousness. And nobody is actually addressing the fundamental structural problems which are related to money. As far as where we go from here, I suspect that we're just going to head further into dysfunction, because we, as we said 7 or 8 years ago, we're heading for economic collapse, and there is no monetary or fiscal measures available in the toolbox anymore. They've used them all. They've printed all the money they can without really causing runaway inflation, which is probably inevitable anyway. Mm-hmm. And they can't raise taxes because people are strapped in any event. So in the last 3 years, they basically sabotaged the economy, and we're now paying the price. But what will happen and what is happening is the structure will change, money will change, and the way we handle value will change. But that's a much bigger debate.
Well, I think this particular sector is obviously something that needs to be somewhat resolved, and rather quickly, because time is running out, Shabir Rizvi, if you agree. And I'm going to tell you why, based on this one particular piece of news, which it's been contested, but it's still shocking, because the numbers could be this high. And the source of this said, it's a website that said up to 500 people dying each week from emergency care delays, the bad flu season compounding with systemic problems leading to unnecessary deaths, a patient waiting 99 hours for a bed at Great Western Hospital in Swindon, which is one of the most extreme cases. So if we're looking at that, along with the fact that you're looking at nurses leaving en masse because of a decade of poor pay, 25,000 to have left just last year, you have a problem. People are dying. So this needs to somehow be resolved, doesn't it?
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be back again, Kavi. Look, as my colleague described, that it's a structural problem. And not only is it a structural problem, I think it's more an ideological and a political conundrum that the government is in. We've had a Tory government now in power, as I have commented previously, for the last 13 years. They have presided over the most stringent form of austerity measures. And what austerity meant was that, you know, the poor people had to, or the lower income people had to tighten their belt. And we were told the sort of story that we are all in it together. In reality, it's only the top 1% who were not in it together. And as we know, over the pandemic, over the last 2 years, the rich and the wealthy have had their wealth increase twice as much, whilst the poor working, the nurses, the firemen, the people working in the railway services, they've all had to sort of have less income in relation to what inflation has done to their income. But I think the important thing is that, yes, deaths are occurring, and this could be sort of, if you like, the effect of the pandemic as well, because for the last 2 years, the cancer patients, the people who've got cardiac issues, older people with multiple sort of health issues have not been seen to in a proper way. I understand that the figure is about 1 million visits, which are outstanding. which have to come through the pipeline. So all those aspects are having an impact. But I think, you know, the government always talks about we don't have the money to sort of give 10%, 12% increase to the employees working in the state sector. We have about 5.5 million people working in the state sector in the UK. But we can find the money to send to Ukraine. We are continuously sort of pumping money in that war. So if that money were not being sort of wasted in that direction, people could be paid better salaries here. And, you know, the whole issue could be resolved very easily. But the, as I said, it's a political and an ideological issue whereby the Tory government always feels that the poor should sort of feel the pain more than the wealthy. And they have gone in that direction for the last 13 years continuously. And the poor have become poorer. And we have, as you know, other commentators and myself have said that in UK, we have over 5 million people going to the food banks. These are working poor, if you like. They don't have enough income to be able to sort of feed their families. Right. And with the cost of living crisis and the sort of energy bills that are coming through the door, that is putting a huge pressure on people's purses. Hence, they want more money so that they can have a reasonable living standard.
Sure. Well, maybe it's a good time to ask this question, Clive Menzies, as to the structure that exists in the, for example, the public health sector vis-a-vis the private sector for health services in terms of going to private, I guess, either doctors or what have you to deal with health-related issues. Because as it is, if we're looking at this many deaths happening in a week, I would call that an emergency situation, but maybe because people can't afford it. And I'm asking this question because Shabir Rizvi talked about how you know, the poor obviously can't afford going to a private doctor maybe, and they need to go to a public doctor. Is that how it works in the UK? And if that's the case, the bigger question is based on a statement by one analyst is that the government is doing this on purpose because they want to privatize the health system. Is that the case?
Well, there's a lot of questions to explore there. First, on the question of excess deaths, not only the excess deaths arising due to stress on the NHS itself, but the NHS has been complicit in promoting excess deaths through an elephant in the room that nobody is discussing, and that's people dying through vaccination. Post-mortem data is coming out in droves in that fashion. And the I'm not sure what the current number is, but our excess death numbers every week are way in excess of the averages. So it's not purely down to the inadequacy of the NHS. As far as private healthcare is concerned, there was a secret report produced, I think, around 2005 that was leaked. And basically, when Thatcher left office, who would never have dared try and privatise the NHS, the management costs, in other words, the non-medical costs, were 3%. By 2005, that had risen to 14% as more and more layers of management were put into the NHS. And the American model, which is the insured model, at that time was 20%. I suspect it's larger now because you have the Obama healthcare, the Obamacare provisions. So private provision or public provision is not really the issue here. And there is a much deeper issue as to whether our healthcare system, the conventional allopathic medical system, is fit for purpose, because actually the primary responsible for one's health, responsibility for one's health, is oneself. And there is much that we can do personally to avoid taking medications that are harmful, mm-hmm. to eat healthily, to not do all the things that are bad for us. So there are, this is a very wide-ranging discussion that goes sure. way beyond money, but money is the medium by which everything is being mediated. And as Shabir has said, you know, we've got money galore for the green agenda and all sorts of, in Britain, our freedoms are being curtailed by remodeling of the roads to cut out car usage. So all this money is being spent. Okay. It's not been spent in the right way.
Right. Well, let's move on to a broader picture here when it comes to strikes. Shabir Rizvi. I mean, the UK is, if I may use the word plague, is plagued with strikes because we're looking at what happened last year and now through this new year, which is not so new anymore. Just last week, you had 500,000 who went on a strike, the largest strike in over a decade. Teachers, civil servants, train drivers, and university lecturers. You can't have a country that keeps going on strikes in the volume and the numbers that the UK is experiencing. And you have the Prime Minister saying, pay rises need to be reasonable and affordable, and issuing a warning that big pay rises would jeopardize attempts to tame inflation. I mean, what does he call big pay rises? If you have 10% inflation on paper, or 11, and some say it's going to go up to 20.
Well, look, at the end of the day, the classical economist will tell you that wage price inflation is what Britain is in at this moment. If wages or salaries increase by what inflation is, that will feed into more inflation, and then you'll have a vicious cycle of higher and higher inflation. That's one sort of economic theory, if you like, which is being sort of pushed forward by the government because it thinks from an economic model whereby that approach is being applied. However, on the other hand, just looking at sort of healthcare, particularly, Britain still spends only between 8% and 9% of the GDP on healthcare, whilst if you have the US model, which is a insurance-based model, they spend 19% to 20% of the GDP on healthcare. So really, I just often when I think about this, I really can't fathom how the private healthcare model is a success. Yes, it is argued that, you know, if you pay for the money, therefore you can get the operations done quicker and you don't have to sort of wait for your turn. So there's a rationing, if you like, in UK through the waiting list. But in the US and other countries where you have insurance, it's sort of rationing by money, if you like. If you have money, you can get the things done. But at a sort of bigger sort of level, the question that you were posing, that yes, it is quite an interesting situation that we have at this moment, that many professions which never took strike action, particularly the nurses, which for the first time in their history were taking strike action. And then you had university professors, as you said, university lecturers and so on, and other sort of public sector employees who are taking action on a regular basis. So Britain is in a sort of a difficult situation. And I think what the ruling elite is trying to do is what Margaret Thatcher did 40 years ago to muzzle the unions. Margaret Thatcher took on the miners' union at that time and completely destroyed the mining communities. And 40 years later, certain parts of the UK, which were based on, the economies were based on coal mine. They got coal mines. They're still sort of suffering 40 years later, two generations later.
Right.
So what I think this government is doing, and there is discussion now that they want to pass new legislation whereby, strike action will not be allowed. There will be sort of other restrictions whereby taking a strike action would not be easy. Therefore, what they're trying to do, I suspect, through this particular approach is to incapacitate the unions and the power that they may have at this moment to fight for their members and demand better income and better sort of quality of work.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Well, that's been a controversial issue, Clive Menzies, if you agree. The way that the government is introducing legislation to stop the strike action. But they've applied that to, sectors that involve either health or security, to put it in a general sense here. But in terms of the government response is what I want to ask you. I'm looking at the statement made by Sharon Graham, leader of the Unite Union. She has said that she wanted Sunak to come to the negotiating table, and she says this government is putting lives at risk. Rishi Sunak has said, I've held constructive talks with the trade unions on pay and affordability and continue to urge them to call off the strikes. Either Sunak is not saying the truth or Sharon Graham is not. Which is it, do you think?
Well, I think they're both operating under an illusion, and I'm not convinced that unions are what they were 40 years ago. I think they're very much part of the problem. What we're witnessing is, through these strikes and what we saw through COVID, was the deliberate, premeditated destruction of the economy. Shabir mentioned wage push inflation, which was a reality in the 1970s. I don't think it's something we can ignore. But I think as far as the percentage we spend on healthcare is concerned, and he was comparing that with 19% America, for America, that is not much of that is actually going on healing people. Most of it is going into those that control money, who control the pharmaceutical industry, the oil industry, and every other industry. So in terms of how do we bridge this gap between Sunak and Sharon, I didn't catch her second name.
It's okay.
It's an irreconcilable gap at the current stage. It is inevitable, and you talk about inflation at 10%. I would suggest to you that for a large proportion of the poorer people, inflation is much higher. And average inflation statistics are invariably misleading, as are many statistics, because within those averages there are a huge number of different experiences, and our research would suggest that inflation is probably running much higher than claimed okay. by the official figures.
All right. Since we're running out of time here, I'm trying to understand, based on my thoughts, where to go with you, Shabir Rizvi, on my next question. And all I could come up with here is when you take a look at the different economic factors or indicators of the UK, it doesn't look good. So my question to you is a headline that I read, which is really quite shocking in a sense. It talked about the lost decade, where the UK may be facing a lost decade of growth if action isn't taken to address the different issues that it's dealing with. And it really looked at business investment and also worker shortages. First of all, do you think that the UK has reached a point or is going down a path that it may lead to a lost decade? Explain to us what that means. We know that Japan went through it. And also, what is the government actually shaping itself to deal with it if this is a path that the UK is going down in?
Well, not only are we facing a lost decade, but we've had a lost decade which has just gone by since the financial crisis of 2008. More than a decade has been lost, where the standard of living of the ordinary people has been reduced drastically, where working conditions have deteriorated, where people are working longer hours, some people are doing two or multiple jobs to ends meet. And then on top of that, you have crisis upon crisis. The whole sort of COVID issue, as my colleague has quite eloquently pointed out, has had its impact. But the real issue is, as I keep sort of reminding your viewers, is that there is a fundamental problem in the UK, the way the political system and the economic system is operating. It is operating in the interest of 1%. And that 1% really, or even less than 1%, is not very much interested in the ordinary people. What British government or the Tory parties would like is, as some people have said, that Singapore on the Thames, whereby there is very little sort of regulation, and then the employees are exploited as much as possible. However, Singapore has a different model, and they've done very well in some ways for their population. Mm-hmm. But here we have a 70 million population. We have disparity between north and south of the United Kingdom. We have within London pockets of extreme poverty.
Okay.
If you walk anywhere in London at this time or over the last previous few years, people are sleeping on the streets as well.
If it's that bad, and I'm guessing it is since you're saying that, Shabir Rizvi, Clive Menzies, do you think that the line has been crossed? This strike that took place last week, it was very telling because you had so many people and they were all standing. And I think they were looking down at Downing Street, if I'm not mistaken. But they were just standing and the looks on their faces, it looked like desperation in a sense. They want their situation to be resolved. Are we looking at a point where the 1%, if the government favors them, that that's not going to matter because people are going to get desperate and numbers are going to overwhelm that 1%. Quickly, if you can, under a minute.
Okay. The government isn't in control, and looking to the government to resolve this probably isn't going to work. The Labour Party, led by Keir Starmer, he's a member of the Trilateral Commission, which is one of these global think tanks, and they're all following the same script. The only way that this is going to change is through structural change, and that is people taking back responsibility for themselves and each other and helping each other, because the systems of government and the structures that are provided are no longer fit for purpose.
Thank you. Thank you, Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst from London, and also from London, Shabir Rizvi, economic analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batakway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of